Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening once again. We are here, Madame Perry Salon, the podcast with more celebrities than the inauguration. But that's not what we're here to talk about. Hey, listen, we had so much fun last night with Jim Musgrave, fun last week with Timlyn Langan, Adrian Ash, and then come out tomorrow night, we have a poet. But tonight, I have a very special guest, and we'll be back with her in just 1 minute, because you know who hasn't been here yet, and that is my, my doorman. So let me let him do his job. I don't want anyone to be to feel not needed.
General quarters. Security condition 3.
GQ. Security 3, sir. General quarters 3. Intruder alert. GQ 3. Intruder alert.
And, of course, you know it's not really an intruder. It's me. But he does a great job, and I love him. I'm so proud of him. Say, listen, you know I told you that this is going to be a very special night. And if you've followed any of my social media, you're already checking on that and you've seen it. Tonight's guest, she's actually, I think of her as a filmmaker as well as an author and food historian. I don't even know where to begin this time, but I can tell you this. She's the author of Cuisine and Culture, A History of Food and People, which is used to teach food history in culinary schools throughout the U.S. and Canada. The first edition won the Gourmand Award for Best Culinary History Book in English. You've seen this woman on television, on the radio. She's been on TV on Bizarre Foods, specifically on the show, on the episodes featuring Halloween and aphrodisiacs. She's on NPR, the BBC. She's currently writing food and film from Prohibition to James Bond. And let me see. Oh, she's also quite, she's taught the history of chocolate at UCLA Extension. But you know what? We're here tonight to talk about her current book, Baking Powder Wars, The Cutthroat Food Fight That Revolutionized Cooking. Now, well, wait a minute. She left again, so I'm not sure what happened. She was here. Maybe I didn't have her the line. I'm going to call her back into the studio. But you know what? I'm happy to tell you that, she's on the East, on the West Coast. The West Coast is a little bit of a different vibe. So, anyway, like I said, the story has everything. It's got Jesse James, the Klan, the Mafia, chocolate chip cookies, how donuts were started, as well as a recipe for 400 large or 500 small donuts. And, of course, I'm talking about Baking Powder Wars author Linda Civitello. Linda, welcome to Madame Perry's Salon.
Well, thank you very much. I am happy to be here.
I am thrilled to have you here. And how are things on the West Coast? How's your weather? Have you baked anything today?
I did, actually, and I've been using heirloom flour a lot. I made some caramel almond biscotti to go with my cappuccino ice cream. And the weather here is, I don't know, it's 78 or 80 or so. It's, you know, T-shirt and shorts weather. Sorry.
Okay, that's all I want to hear about that, okay? I'll just dream on about the caramel biscotti and the cappuccino ice cream. Listen, I am loving your book, Baking Powder Wars, Cutthroat History, of the cutthroat food fight that revolutionized cooking. You know, it's the kind of thing that when I first saw the book and the description, I was thinking, oh, baking powder wars. But then because of that, I think it was what bullet holes in the can on the cover, and I thought, oh, let me check this out, and I read about it. Who knew? Who knew this was such a wild history? And it also goes to prove there is absolutely nothing new under the sun as far as dirty dealing and backstabbing and business to get ahead.
True. It's
anybody
true.
That thinks,
I was stunned. Go ahead.
No. So tell me, what brought you to write this book? And just to, I mean, I know you're a food historian, but to study the history of baking powder and its effect
well,
on
I
culture
started,
in particular.
I wanted to do breakfast. I'd been researching breakfast for a while. And, I mean, 10 or 15 years ago, I was giving talks on how dessert became breakfast, which the rest of the world finally caught up with me and went, oh, yeah, we're having dessert for breakfast. But I saw that years and years ago. So I was writing about breakfast. And, you know, of course, and then I thought I'm going to deconstruct it. I'm going to look at the ingredients. I'm going to look at, you know, what goes into pancakes, what goes into waffles. So it's like, what's happened to flour? It's got refined and white. What's happened to sugar? It's got refined and white. You know, eggs have gotten bigger. You know, bacon, just what is, you know, like a lumberjack breakfast. So I was looking at all kinds of breakfast things, and I thought, wow, this is just like a ginormous topic. I mean, it's so huge. So let me start with something small, which would be like, you know, what leavens everything? Because that, you know, I'm looking at it and going, oh, the common denominator in the muffins, in the rolls, in the pancakes, in the waffles, in the biscuits, it's baking powder. And I thought, oh, you know, I'll put like a paragraph or so about baking powder because, you know, who thinks about baking powder? And, you know, it's like a nothing, you know, it's just a non-ingredient. Nobody thinks about it. Mm-hmm. So I figured I'd find enough for, you know, a paragraph, two paragraphs. And I'd say, yeah, and you're like, and of course, there's baking powder. And then it was like, are you kidding me? When I started finding thousands and thousands of pages and court cases going up to the United States Supreme Court and every state legislature and, you know, chambers of Congress and repeated over the years, you know, congressional hearings and state health boards and people going to jail over baking powder and newspaper articles And I couldn't believe it. But as a historian, I went, oh, this is the mother lode. Oh, yeah. You know, this is like you dream of this. Once in a lifetime, you go, are you kidding? How have we forgotten this? How did this disappear? And this is what I love as a historian, that when you get into something and you go, this is insane. And, you know, we forget. You know, because when I taught history, I'd have students do a history of their families. We really don't know anything past like our grandparents' generation. Some people, maybe great-grandparents, and you know, some families have done genealogy, but it's the same with history. We just don't know. And this all happened around 1900 and then the Depression. But, I mean, for 100 years, people were fighting over baking powder and saying, I'm going to, you know, run you out of business if it takes my fortune or my life. I mean, it was that intense.
And sometimes it did, didn't it?
Yeah. People just, you know, people did go bankrupt. People, you know, and when they went and testified, and then they got really dirty trying to drive each other out of business. So, and there was a lot of money in baking powder. So you had millions and millions of dollars there to do dirty deeds with.
You know, one of the first things I remember, I think in the it might have been in the first chapter of the book, and it talks about how there were a few cookbooks, because I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, if this is at that time it was one of the few respectable ways for a woman to earn money. I think specifically if she was widowed or something.
Women ran, they ran boarding houses, you know, and they've always been connected to food. You know, you could take in laundry, and then when factories started to come along. But, you know, if you had a good, you know, table, if you could provide good food, you could certainly charge more money. And a lot of the women who wrote cookbooks early on were what historians call women on the margins. These are women who didn't have husbands or fathers or, you know, families. These are women who had to support themselves. For instance, Catherine Beecher was engaged and her fiancé died at sea and she never married. So, you know, she spent the rest of her life doing domestic science, as it was called then. And Amelia Simmons, the first American cookbook, she says, I'm an orphan. I'm an American orphan. But women can be respectable and earn a living and support themselves by cooking. And I will tell you how in this book. So, yes, I mean, because, you know, you didn't go outside the home if you were a woman. The first girls who went outside the home were the daughters of Yankee farmers, because the land was played out, and in the first industrial revolution in America, they went to work in the textile factories in Massachusetts, and, you know, because women were also connected with spinning and weaving and textiles. So those were the three things you did as a woman in the 18th century and well into the 19th were you had children, you provided food for your family, and you provided clothing for your family. And you see this like in Paul Revere's house. If you go into his historic homes, you'll see at the hearth, there's the hearth, a big fireplace, because that's where the cooking went on, and next to it is the spinning wheel and the cradle. And that was your life.
That was, yes. Oh, listen, by the way, if you're listening to us live tonight, and this is Tuesday night, and I'm talking with Linda Civitello about her book, The Baking Powder Wars. You can give us a call. You can call and talk to Linda. The number is 646-716-9922. That's 646-716-9922. And Linda would love to talk to you, so would I. And Linda, we do have a caller in here. Looks like it could be. I may be wrong, but could be from... I don't know. Is this from Louisiana? Hi, welcome to Madame Perry's Salon. I'm here with Linda Civitello.
Yes, hi. Hello. I need two supreme pizzas, one with one no cheese on it, one with no cheese, please. I can't handle the cheese. And
if you want a baking powder base, if you want a baking powder base, you know, we can talk about that, you know, but otherwise that's the yeast dough. And I'm sorry, that is the food of my people. I'm an Italian American, but you know, what else can anything else we can help you with here?
No, I'm sorry, I was messing with you.
Okay.
Linda, this is suspense author. I recognize this voice. This is the suspense author, Carrie Dunn, calling from Baton Rouge or New Orleans. Carrie, and
I'm sorry about that. I didn't mean to.
Where are you calling? Where are you calling from?
New Orleans, Louisiana.
Oh, okay. I'm going to be speaking there in March at a conference on chemistry and food.
Really?
So,
cool.
Yep. I'm going to be talking about the evolution of flour and also things that have changed our eating habits drastically, like freezing, the cold chain, and, you know, some other things. So, because we've gone from pretty much medieval theory in the beginning until about 1848 to molecular gastronomy in about 130 years or so. So we're moving at the speed of light, and baking powder was one of those things that has completely changed everything the way we eat. It has made things faster, cheaper, and easier, and that's what Americans have been looking for. And there it is in baking powder, and it also resulted in America's bread, which is the baking powder biscuit, which is a soft, crustless bread.
Mm-hmm.
And there you go. And it's very versatile. You can dress it up, dress it down. You can go savory. You can go sweet. And when you look at what it took to make bread in the beginning of the 19th century, in the 18th century, where people were eating about a pound of bread per person per day. So bread is the mainstay. It's not, would you like some bread with that? It's, do you want something to go with the bread? And sometimes all you had to go with that bread was tea, maybe butter and jam. And, I mean, it took you all day to bake this. You're baking 25, 30 pounds of flour and plus gallons of water and homemade yeast. And then that bread's going to last you for a week. So let me ask you this. Do you want that bread that's a week old, or do you want baking powder biscuits hot out of the oven?
And I'll take them hot out of the oven. Yeah, right, right.
Well, I think much more highly of you now for your answer. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm from the South. You can give me hot biscuits any time of day. I'm okay with that. Would you say your book? Because I was reading the description, and I'm sorry I wasn't familiar with your work. But reading your description of what this book entails and everything, is it more of a historical or scientific or sociological kind of way that?
Yes.
All three? Okay.
It covers a lot of turf because I start, the first chapter is bread before baking powder. You know, what it was like, the importance of bread in British culture and American culture. And again, where women had to make their own yeast. Commercial yeast was not widely available in the United States until the Fleischmann brothers brought it over from Vienna in 1876 at the Philadelphia Exposition, the centennial, our, you know, America's 100th birthday party. So, yes, it's all of those things. It's about what these women's lives were like and why they were looking, why they were experimenting. I mean, these are desperate people. You look at what they're putting in the food to try to get it to leaven, and somebody has the bright idea, you know, and she's, whoever she is, we don't know her name, but, you know, people had smelling salts in their houses, and, you know, you look at this and somebody must have said, well, if this can revive you and get you up, it's going to get my pancakes up too. So they started putting smelling salts in the food, so volatile. Oh, yeah, because it's got ammonia in it. And in England they were using hydrochloric acid. I mean, this is how much these people want a shortcut. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's why I'm looking at this. So, yes, the science part is there. And then also, then, you know, cream of tartar, sodium aluminum sulfate, phosphates, I mean, just all these different formulas and ways of experimenting to try to get a leavening in there. And then they get cream of tartar in baking soda, but it won't work with, you know, some citrus things. You know, reacts badly with acid. Some things, the very first thing they tried was ashes. You know, and before you go, you know, it's like, what do you mean ashes? It's ashes have been used like lye in lutefisk and other places. So they're using
they
ashes.
They use lye to make bread?
Yep. Well, it was called pearl ash, which was super refined ashes. And that's actually in the first chapter. That's the very first patent that was ever issued in the United States was for pearl ash, was for this super refined ash. Well, it was used for other things, too, like making glass and, you know, and things. But it's just amazing. But that, the big drawback with that was anything you use that in, if you didn't mix it properly, it would leave flecks. It would leave very unattractive and bad-tasting flecks. And also, the minute it came in contact with liquid, you had to put it in the oven. So if you said, oh, I want to put it in another pan, or, oh, I want to, it's like, too late, you know, it's like the thing has fallen. And the biggest drawback on pearl ash, this ash-based leavener, and it says this in one of the cookbooks, is if you combine this with water, pearl ash with water, and it falls on the floor, some of it spills on the floor, do not leave it any length of time, for it will strip the paint off the floorboards.
One of them. But you're going to eat it. But go ahead and eat hearty. Yeah, just chow down on
and
the
I
bread.
Was thinking...
Yes. So, yes, in addition, you know, it's science. It's, you know, it's a history of business. It's the history of cookbooks. Because I wanted to trace how this spread, because this baking powder is technology, it's new technology. How does it spread? How do people learn to use it? You know, now it's like you want to know something, you go on the internet. Well, back then, women were writing. There was tremendous literacy among women, especially in the Northeast. By 1840, almost there was almost 100% literacy among women in the Northeast. So they're writing cookbooks. They're sending, you know, they're making diaries. They're trading recipes. They're reading cookbooks, and they're doing all this. And you see it spreading into the Midwest. In the South, a lot of it was still beaten biscuits. And those were always a sign of hospitality. Very often throughout history, things that were considered signs of hospitality meant, you know, like my people of color who are making this food are better than your people in the kitchen. Beaten biscuits, you know, beat those 500 times with an axe handle. You had to beat this for like an hour. And, you know, it was slave labor. It was slave labor that was doing this. So women in the North, I want a shortcut. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. It's just
Are we waiting time for you to breathe? What are we doing here?
Yes. You know, Linda, okay. I would just pay just for you to do You should just do stand-up. You should just be, you know, at Carnegie Hall.
You don't need to 911 yourself or anything, do you?
No, you don't need to
911 yourself. No, okay.
I hope not. Okay, but also I was going to say we got another caller coming in, so stay with me just for a second.
Oh my God,
if you want to talk,
I'm so excited. I have to go now. What? No.
No.
Other caller.
Linda. If you want to talk to Linda Civitello here, it's 646-716-9922, and I'm going to. I think this is also somebody who's rather familiar, maybe in Madame Perry's salon, Carrie. I'm just thinking about beaten biscuits, beating the biscuits with an axe handle 500 times. Hi, welcome to Madame Perry's Salon. I'm here with Linda Civitello talking about baking power wars.
You know, I have heard the term butter my butt and call me a biscuit, but beaten biscuits for 500 times? Holy crap.
Yeah, well, they finally created a machine to do that around 1900 because you had to beat the biscuits until the dough blistered. This was how you incorporated air into the dough to leaven it. So finally, yes, a machine around 1900, but, you know, still you had to crank it like crazy. And it looks sort of like an Italian pasta machine, if you know what that looks like. It's a little crank and a couple of rollers. So it's difficult incorporating air into things to leaven them because traditionally you did this, you made a sponge. Okay, whip those egg whites or you know, like beat the whole egg, the yolk and the ribbon, the yolk and the white and the sugar until you get a ribbon. You know, that's 10 minutes on an electric stand mixer. So you've got recipes that say beat the eggs for an hour, or you separate the whites from the yolks and you beat the whites. And of course, the difficulty there is if you get any little teeny tiny itsy bitsy bit of yolk or any kind of fat, or the beaters aren't completely clean, the whites will just sit there and look at you and go, not now, ha, 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 you know. And it's just, we've all had that happen. It's like, what got in there? I hate these egg whites. So,
how you end up with a sponge cake square pancake on the bottom of the oven.
With a hole in the middle, which is a big crater in the middle. That's a crater cake, your average crater cake. Yes, that's what that is about. So baking powder, on the other hand, baking powder is foolproof. Baking powder doesn't care if it's hot or it's cold or it's wet or it's dry or you did this a million times or you've never baked anything before in your life. It's like, all right, let me add it. I'm gonna raise it. I'm gonna make it puff up. Oh yeah, oh yeah. You know, it's like a dog. It's like a puppy. Yeah. I'm gonna do this. So, that's what baking powder does, and I love it. All right, you know, don't use it against me. No, but really, cooking is a miracle. Chemistry is a miracle. Every time you do something in the kitchen, you transform these ingredients into some other thing, and it's amazing to watch it leaven. You know, it's like nice to watch yeast puff up too, but that takes a long time. So.
Oh yeah.
Anyway. So.
This caller is actually Becky Kyle. She's an author and editor, Linda, and I've never seen or heard her talk about beating a biscuit, but. So.
Well, you know, they say you never really know somebody, right?
Not until you, I always say, you know, not, you know, you can work cheek by jowl with somebody, but until you've beaten a biscuit next to them with them or seen their technique, you don't know them. You just think you do. We've got another caller joining the party here with Becky and Carrie and Linda Civitello. Linda, can
hey,
you
Becky,
handle
by
one
the
more?
Way.
Hey.
Hello.
That's Carrie. Somebody
say Carrie,
something.
Yeah,
all right.
Saying hello.
What?
Oh, hey. All right. Welcome to Madam Perry Salon. We're talking about that. Becky.
Hello,
Salon. Come on in and tell us who you are. Hi.
Well,
who is this?
Hi there. This is Peter G., the animator and the food nut, who you've had on the show a few times before.
Oh, hi, Peter.
Peter G., yes.
Hi there. Yeah, it's. I was calling in especially because I'm listening to the interview, and it's like as she's describing cooking as chemistry. It's like, well, yeah, I've been saying that for years.
Yes,
yeah,
but a lot of
well,
people still don't get it. When Harold McGee wrote the first edition of On Cooking and Chemistry in 1984, he had to explain, I think it was 84, the connection between cooking and chemistry. And when he updated it in, I think it was 2004, he no longer had to have that section in the book. But, you know, people really did not understand this at all. They don't think about science.
Every time I cook, I call it a science experiment. My husband would agree.
Well, I mean, there's people today who still don't get it. I mean, I have a friend who wants to retire and move to Florida. He says he wants to open a pizza parlor there that actually makes good pizza because he's never had good pizza in Florida. And I kept telling him, it's like, well, you're never going to make good pizza because pizza is all about the bread. If the bread doesn't taste good, the pizza doesn't taste good. And the
right.
water in Florida is simply different from the water in Chicago or New York or any of the of the other
it's
pizza capitals.
Terroir. Wherever
right.
you go, it's terroir. And, you know, every good pastry chef has a filtration system. Their special
yeah.
filtration system to
mm-hmm.
take the,
yeah.
the flavors of, you know, because all the water has been treated. And some of it is the yeast. And, you know, any time you're dealing with yeast, you have the variables of weather and humidity and the skill of the cook. You know,
mm-hmm.
not just the flour. You can import that flour from Italy. You can get a water filter. The yeast, and depending on how humid it is, how not humid, how you know what whether it's hot or whether it's cold, and these are variables that baking powder removes, absolutely removes from baking. That's it. It's a chemical leavener, and it doesn't care. That's
mm-hmm.
it. It's going to leaven no matter what.
I had bread fall because I had a cat that jumped on the refrigerator and caused the yeast that was just rising to just go.
Yeah, you scared the yeast. You can't scare baking powder. There you go.
Yeah.
Baking powder is very tough. It won't scare. The only thing you can do that would screw up baking powder would be to put a damp spoon in the can. And they had to, the you know, baking powder manufacturers issued proprietary cookbooks, and then Fannie Farmer came along in the 1890s, and they all said, you know, do not put a damp spoon, you know, like don't measure water or milk or vanilla or something, and then put that spoon in the baking powder can because it does react. And I know you're dying to ask me, and all the people who haven't called in yet, you're all dying to say, Linda, what exactly is that double-acting baking powder? What does that mean, Linda? Tell me. Okay, do you want me
what
to tell you?
What is it? Yes!
I thought it was a double-agent baking powder, but go ahead.
It's a marketing ploy. You know, it's
of
like,
course it is.
You know, when they say it's like olive oil, now gluten-free, you know, so it's double acting it's true, and there are two different leavening agents in your baking powder, and they are held together with cornstarch, which was a cutting-edge product when baking powder was first marketed in the 1850s and 60s. You know, there is nothing more kind of mundane than cornstarch, but back then it wasn't an obvious choice to work in this And that came, a Harvard professor, a chemistry professor, came up with that. So in the 1920s, one of the baking powder companies decides it's going to promote itself as double acting. The first action is when the baking soda hits the liquid. And that, you know, you've done a, you know, a third grade science experiment where you take a teaspoon of baking soda and you put it in some water and you watch it fizz up or, you know, something. And you can see that in the bowl. That's the first action. The second action is when it hits the heat. That's the acid ingredient, whether it's the phosphate, the sodium aluminum, you know, whatever that is. It used to be the cream of, cream of tartar had, this goes to the big rivalry and the baking powder wars, because Royal Baking Powder only was only single acting. It only reacted with the liquid. So here comes its competition, and it's like they cannot counter this. This is a scientific fact, and you can't counter it. Our baking powder acts twice, and yours only acts once, and also ours costs less than yours, and you have to use less of ours than of yours. And that's why Royal Baking Powder is gone now. It's, and what is available in the United States is in the Hispanic communities, and it's the same formula as all the other baking powders, or else you could not have consistency in cookbooks and recipes. And there was not consistency in the joy of cooking until 1995.
Whoa.
So these wars went on a long time, because before that, right, there were pages and pages in Joy of Cooking, and even in the 1940s and into the 50s, I believe, she had parallel recipes in the Joy of Cooking. If you're using this kind of baking powder, you use this much of it, and if you use and you add it at this point. If you're using that kind of baking powder, you add it at that point, and you use this much. And anybody who can read a recipe is looking at the Joy of Cooking going, how come I have to use twice as much of this baking powder? And it costs more already. Mm. So Rombauer became an inadvertent advertiser for all the baking powders that were not Royal, just because she had to explain this, and because it became a national, you know, a huge hit in the national cookbook. So does that answer your question about double acting?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. But there's more questions. There are more questions, Linda. You know, I have been telling everybody that this book has got everything. It's got, you know, mystery, intrigue, of course, desserts, donuts, how they were started, everything. But I said it's got spies. I mean, you know, like the Royal Company had spies working in the Calumet Company that were working there as employees. It's got bribery up into the highest government level, things that went to the Supreme Court. It has Jesse James, the Mafia, the Klan. Tell us, how did a little simple white powder that wasn't that didn't just go straight up somebody's nose just be so gangster?
There you go. When you're talking about white powders, because there are almost parallels with the drug industry, and as a matter of fact, I mean, you know, 100 years ago, well, no, around 1900, nothing was illegal. Government did not consider that it was its business to tell you what to eat or what to drink or what to put in your foods. And then that got abused. So the government said, no, you can't put coal tars, you know, some of these things that are toxic.
Thank you, Upton Sinclair.
Yeah, the jungle. But, see, now everybody goes, oh, yeah, everybody knows about the jungle and the meatpacking industry in Chicago in 1905 and 1906 and the Pure Food and Drug Act. But way before the meat industry was exposed as this horror show, the bread, commercial bread baking was exposed in the 1880s and 1890s. There was a huge case that went up to the Supreme Court called Lochner versus New York, where you had what were called the basement bakers. These guys are working in tenement basements in New York, and they're practically living there because making bread is so time-consuming. And when it's hot, I mean, there's almost no ventilation. They're stripped to the waist. They're carrying the bread around by hugging it to their sweaty torsos.
Yeah.
yet there is no, you know, the floors in many cases were just dirt. You know, and when the law finally got passed, it said, and by the way, you can't have any animals in a bakery except for cats, which means if you got cats, you got what? You got rats. You got vermin. You got stuff. So anyway, so yes, but see, before meat, there was bread. Yeah, and all kinds of arguments were made, like, well, why should the government make my baking powder illegal? Because this is what happened. One of the baking powder companies bribed a state legislature for 6 years to keep all of its competitors' products off the shelf. I'm talking about $1 million worth of food, you know, of baking powder off the shelves, and that's $1 million in 1900.
That was
a lot of money back then. Drove all kinds of people out of business. And people are saying, why can't I have the baking powder that I want, that I've been using, that works for me? One of the arguments they said, you know, a lot of people like to shoot themselves up with morphine, and they sell these cute little hypodermic kits so that people can do that. So why can't I have the baking powder I want? Yes. So, yes. Baking powder.
Well, that's an impressive
argument. The other white powder. I mean, because what we're talking about here is government regulation, and you know, what is the role of the government in regulating and food, and you know, now, I mean, you know, what we're seeing now is, you know, sugar and soft drinks, pate, all kinds of things being regulated by the government. So when the baking powder wars began, there was no regulation. There was no regulation of advertising. So you could make the most fantastic claims. And advertising came out of all that, you know, those snake oil salesmen and the health cures, you know. It's like, ah, yes, our elixir, 2 teaspoons a day will cure, you know, insomnia and if you sleep too much. You know, you look at them. Mm-hmm. They're making absolutely contradictory claims. It's like, are you nervous or are you tired? Our elixir will cure all of that. And the reason it did, because some of that stuff was 25% alcohol. Take 4 times a day. Okay. Yeah, you know, you mm-hmm. will feel better. I mean, going back to the Middle Ages when I thought sugar could cure toothaches. Doctors prescribed sugar for toothaches in the Middle Ages. So, you know, we get all these things coming in, and people will, you know, make what they wish of things and then do things with them. So, but with baking powder, what you're doing is pancakes, waffles, donuts. We reinvented donuts. Baking powder reinvented donuts. There are two different kinds of donuts. One is the puffy yeast donut, the yeast-risen one that's filled with the jelly that's nice and, you know, light and puffy. The other mm-hmm. types of donuts, like the buttermilk bars, the maple bars, those are called cake donuts, and they are made with baking powder.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so we revolutionized, you know, donuts. We reinvented pancakes. We like our food puffy and light. And this is why baking powder is the reason that the expression flat as a pancake has no meaning for Americans. That's it. It's not a crepe. A crepe is flat. And American pancakes are puffy. So mm-hmm. there you go. I love pancakes. Don't tell anybody. All right.
Well, we couldn't have figured that one out.
Well, let's get into the dirt and the crime of all this now, because I was just amazed. I love, by the way, Carrie, you're going to love this too, and actually Becky and also Peter. She has Linda has a great turn of phrase, and here's this one where and like in this one section where Royal has hired detectives to go in and be employees, as I was saying before, in Calumet, and then trying to, you know, use it to, you know, ruin their business, and then there's FTC suit, and then Calumet accuses Royal of industrial espionage, and goes on. I won't tell you what happens next, but then it says, I love this expression, this sentence. It says, Royal's trial brief was an exercise in chutzpah, like the man who kills his parents and then begs for mercy because he's an orphan. Royal claimed Allen was so dangerous that the state had passed legislation to protect the public from it. Then they cited the law that they had bought, the law that they had purchased themselves with bribery. I mean, it was just insane. I mean, the nerve.
Well, it was a precedent, and that was what they intended to do. We're going to bribe the state legislature to make our. Yeah, right. Yeah, I think they're, you know, they're better at covering it up. But yeah, you know, it's like set a precedent, bribe one state to pass a law, and do it under the guise of public health. We're doing this as enlightened public policy. We're doing it because we're concerned about the health of our citizens. And Royal's strategy there was to have this groundswell, this grassroots movement across the United States, and pass this law in as many states as possible, so that when it got time for the pure food and drug law at the federal level, Royal planned to go in and say, look, X number of states have already passed laws making all of our competitors' baking powders illegal, so the federal law should make them illegal too. And so that's why this was a fight for survival, a fight to the death, because the Royal competition, which was a lot of mom and pop baking powder companies, because at that time there were about 534 baking powder companies in the United States, because you could order these, you know, various components of it, the corn starch, mix it up in the back of your little general store, your mom and pop store, slap your own proprietary label on a can, and you've got your own brand of baking powder. But you know, Royal wanted all of these people gone and did their absolute best to make that happen. But it didn't. It did not happen. You know, what really changed the market was the Depression in the 1930s. So yeah, that was another war, a price war. So you have advertising war. You have the legislative wars. You have price wars. You have cookbook wars. You have women getting very, very vociferous about this, like, and don't use that brand of baking powder, or my family has always eaten this brand of baking powder. And then, you know, some of the baking powder businessmen getting very angry. And one of them, Davis Baking Powder, and he's from Jersey, you know, goes into one of these congressional hearings, and he's like keeping his temper, and he's answering all the questions, and finally he says, you people know as much about baking powder as a cow knows about algebra. And it's like, this is not the way to get Congress on your side, you know? So
it is amazing to me how well you know your subject. I'm just sitting here kind of flabbergasted. It's pretty amazing.
Well, I mean, I lived with it for a long time, and, you know, and I keep seeing baking powder in my kitchen. It's everywhere. It's everywhere.
It's everywhere.
It is. I mean, you know, anytime a cake, you know, cakes, crullers, just so many things, again, you know, made with baking powder, and we don't think about it enough. We just don't think about it enough. No, it's so I'm doing all the thinking about baking powder for you. So, anyway.
Oh,
so is that
thank
another
you.
Caller? Was that
no,
another caller?
That's
no.
No, that's one of you guys somewhere. So
sorry,
that was me.
I'm sorry. The phone. I have a tendency to get telemarketers that will call three at a time, so they will jam up both of the sidelines, and if one of the lines gets clear, it jumps right back on again. So every time it rings, I'm literally slamming multiple buttons. I apologize for that.
Whoa.
That's okay.
All right. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry I have to sign off, but it's been a pleasure in listening to you and everything tonight, Ms. Sabatello.
Well, thank you.
I'm going to listen to the rest of it while I cook dinner here, but fascinating.
What are you making?
All right, thanks for calling. Yes. What are you making, Harry?
Something quick on the stove. Nothing with baking powder in it, though, surprisingly. I didn't want any ashes in my chicken. But, no.
Well. Well, enjoy your dinner.
Well, thank you, and it was
all
a pleasure
right,
listening
calling.
To you and talking to you. Y'all have
thank
a good
you.
Night, everybody. Thank you.
Oh, you
all
too,
right, thanks,
bye-bye.
Carrie.
Carrie, bye-bye.
My mother would only let us buy Calumet baking powder. I don't know why. I mean, I said, well, here's this stuff called Clabber Girl, which sounds kind of gross because isn't Clabber things bad? And she's like, you don't buy
no,
that. You
no,
buy
no,
Calumet.
No, no, no. No, Clabber, if something is Clabber, that's when you get before milk used to be ultra pasteurized and processed and everything. It would get into a beautiful, thick ferment when it started to go bad. And I remember when, as a kid, we got cream from our local dairy, and when the cream started to thicken and mm-hmm. become sour, that's mm-hmm. what we used in our pancakes, in addition to baking. I mean, that made a beautiful, beautiful thing. So Clabber Girl baking powder was originally called Clabber, the idea being that the baking powder would do the kind of leavening that you got from naturally fermented milk, and then they changed the name in 1923 to comply with the FTC just to make sure that there was no mistake. And they had a pretty young girl on the label, and that's who did the cooking and still does mm-hmm. in homes very often, is the teenage daughter. And, you know, people would come in, customers would come in, and they'd say, oh, you know, give me that baking powder with the Clabber Girl mm-hmm. one. And they said, yeah, that's it. Here, we're just going to call it that. You know, you look at the labels, and I do go into the sort of art history label colors, schemes and things. They're red, they're orange, they're bright, they're, you know, they've got a chef, they've got this, they've got that, and it's like, and here's Clabber Girl, and it's white and gray, and it looks sort of like a charcoal sketch, and it's, you know, and she's from the mm-hmm. 1920s, and they haven't changed her much, you know, she's still there, and she's got a plate of biscuits, and that's what you would be making. I mean, that's, you know, mm-hmm. so Calumet, again, the baking powders are interchangeable now. There would be no consistency whatsoever in the cookbooks. But in the early, early days, this is probably something, your mother's attitude probably came from her mother, or even farther back, where you might have, you know, experimented with different kinds of baking powder. And then when you find one that's reliable, it's like, there you go. We're sticking with this one, you know.
That's probably it.
Yeah, because they were not interchangeable. I mean, you could not pick up a cookbook put out by Royal Baking Powder and a cookbook put out by Calumet and use the other baking powder to make them. The Calumet would cause, and believe me, I have done all of these experiments, so you don't have to. But if you use the amount of Calumet that used to be called for in a Royal baking powder recipe, it will overrise, and the biscuits will or muffins, I think I made, you know, like chocolate cupcakes or something, they will puff up and they will be lopsided. They will look like a, you know, like a cap from the night before Christmas, one of those nightcaps, nightwear things.
Oh,
you know, like
man.
Lopsided, where, you know, it's like it's up, but then it collapses down on one side. And you will be able to taste it, and it tastes bitter. So those will be overrisen. And if you used, you know, or you'll get something underrisen. It just, these things just don't, they were not interchangeable. And as I said, the, you know, so 1995, Joy of Cooking, she stops talking about double acting. But the last Royal cookbook was printed in about 1950, and then they did not come out with a new one. I think 1955 or, you know, 58 or so was really the last cookbook. And I'm going, we're single acting. Yeah, we're single acting, and that's better. And nobody was buying it, literally, at that point. So, yeah, I mean, you know, if you got a brand that works for you, that works for you.
I'm terrible. I very seldom get in and bake stuff anymore. But
oh
I remember.
Oh, my God. And I'm talking to you anyway.
Ow.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Because.
Oh, my God.
Hey, you know, I'm the queen of soup, but I don't. Well, the other thing is I have a slight flour allergy, too. Keep in mind, I have a slight wheat allergy. So, you know. Yeah.
Now, well, fortunately, you know, baking powder, one of the big, big pluses of baking powder back in the 19th century was that corn was such a common grain in America, unlike the rest of the world. And yeast does nothing to corn because corn, no gluten.
Yep.
So you can throw that stuff in. New England, they made a dish was like a bread that was part rye and part corn, and sometimes it was half and half, and sometimes it was two-thirds of one and a third of the other, but it would have been the yeast in the rye, I mean the gluten in the rye, and rye does not have a lot of gluten, and the gluten it has is weak, so that's what would cause the leavening, but that was a very, very dense bread. So corn muffins, baking powder, and corn go together very well. So and there's a classic in New England, it's called a thirded bread, which they Boston brown bread, which is a third corn, rye, and a third wheat with a little molasses and some raisins in it or maple syrup or something, which is a very wholesome, delicious muffin. And I think baking soda, baking powder. But, well, I'm so sorry about your wheat allergy. That's it's in a lot of things and a lot of good things. I suppose then you have to console yourself with just ice cream then, Becky, or?
No, I occasionally eat it. I mean, I just try to keep it. I try to keep it, you know, one serving of something with wheat in it a day. If that makes any sense. I mean, you know, I'm allergic to cats and Bermuda grass and oak and maple and I can't remember what else. I mean, so I do my best to be responsible about it so I just don't snot the world.
You know, Becky, I should have planned to have Linda here on Valentine's because she has been featured on shows about chocolate and aphrodisiacs. So, you know, she's she knows everything.
There is nothing better than dark chocolate, very, very dark chocolate with sea salt. There is nothing better.
I'm glad that works for you.
That's my favorite
candy
thing.
Candy or baked goods? What do you?
Or bark.
Things leavened
just
with baking
chocolate
powder.
Chocolate bark.
Or candy.
Yeah, bark. You know, they literally not sweet, salt, that savory bark. Yeah, when I say I like cacao, I like cacao, but I like it just about as straight as you can get it.
Wow. Well, you know, a lot of recipes, you know, well, some recipes will call for baking powder and baking soda. And you look at them and you go, isn't there baking soda already in baking powder? Yes, there is. But
good question.
If you've got something that's high in acid, like chocolate, or the other one is buttermilk, then you're going to use baking soda. You might use baking powder and baking soda. You know, give it just a little extra boost. Sometimes it's baking soda, but that's why you might see both of those things in the same recipe. It's because you've got something acidic in it.
Citrus as well, I think.
Yeah, especially buttermilk.
Okay.
You know, buttermilk and chocolate or chocolate buttermilk cake. There you go. Yeah, throw a little coffee in there, too.
All right. Okay, let me just say one more time, if you're listening live and you want to talk to Linda Civitello here with Madam Perry Salon, who I am thrilled to have her here in the Genie Bottle, the number is 646-716-9922, 646-716-9922. And Linda's book, we're talking about wars, the cutthroat history of
wars.
Baking powder wars. We've only got a few more. Go ahead, cutthroat. Say it, girl.
What? Baking powder wars, the cutthroat food fight that revolutionized cooking. It's true.
And speaking of cutthroat, and yes, you can still call. We got about 5 more minutes of Linda here. Linda, to get into the cutthroat part, I'm going to ask you just to pick any one of these you want to talk about for the next couple of minutes. And two, well, I've got also Peter and Becky here. There's the Jesse James, the Mafia, the Klan.
Mafia?
What else?
No, I don't think so. No,
no Mafia?
Not the Mafia.
Did I just make
Let's
that
Let's talk about the Klan.
Okay. And the Clabber
Well,
girl.
The Klan in the company that created Clabber Girl was German Catholic immigrants.
Hmm.
And this was a problem. And, first, World War One was a huge problem. Most of the cities in the United States called Berlin or other names of German cities disappeared. German disappeared from schools, German language newspapers. People stopped speaking German. Huge, huge, you know, we had Liberty Cabbage instead of sauerkraut and Liberty Dogs. There was already a tremendous
backlash. Oh, for God's
sake.
Liberty Steak instead of hamburger.
Excuse me. I don't know if you remember when during the Iraq War, France objected to us. And remember, everybody was eating freedom fries. They're not French fries.
Yeah.
Freedom fries. So food reflects what's going on politically, racially, and, you know, all kinds of other things. If it's in the culture, it's going to be in food. And anyway, so coming off of World War One and all of this tremendous anti-German sentiment, you had the rise of the Klan in the 1920s, and they were very powerful in Indiana, in Oregon, you know, not confined to the South by any means. And, they were anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish, you know, anti-black, of course, anti, you know, any people of color, anti-immigrants. And here's Clabber Girl, which, you know, the whole family, German Catholics, and they kept bringing relatives over and friends, you know, people over, and they would start them working in the motor pool or the stables before they had cars, and until these people got assimilated and then, you know, could work their way up in the company. And the family was named Holman, and they were very prominent in Terre Haute, Indiana, and they were philanthropists. They donated tremendous amounts of time and money and energy into the community, but the Klan had a huge march. I think it was April 24th, 1923, right down the main street, right in front of the store, in front of the, you know, this five or six story store and warehouse and place where the baking powder was manufactured, down to the courthouse at the river. And I mean, there were deaths. There were arson fires. I mean, this Klan and Americans who were against the Klan got violent, and women were involved in this. And any business that was not what the Klan called 100%ers, which was white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, was at risk. So, they weathered this, the Clabber Girl and the Holman family, and that building is still there. It's now the Clabber Girl Museum, and there is a kitchen and, where I believe they have cooking classes, and you can go in and get some very wonderful baking powder biscuits if you're ever in Terre Haute. So...
That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing, you know, business, you know, you look at government regulation and it's not enough. You got, like, how am I going to market this product? I have this great product. Who's the market? What's it going to cost me to get a campaign? What do I use as a logo or a meme or a slogan? And, you know, what is the government going to tell me I can do? Where am I getting my ingredients, my supplies? You know, is the weather going to interrupt my, you know, shipping this out or, you know, receiving goods? And then it's like, oh, yeah. And it's like, I don't have enough problems. Here comes the Klan. So, So,
is it that?
You know, all kinds of variables in doing business. So,
no kidding.
Yeah.
Well, sadly, our time is up, and this has just flown. I don't know about you, Linda, but this has flown by for me, and it's been very exciting to have you here. Thank you. So, folks,
well,
we've been listening. Listen, this is a delight. I am just so thrilled to have you here because this book is just like I would read a chapter and have to go back and read it again. But thanks to Carrie Dunn, Peter G., and Becky Kyle for joining us here tonight. And remember, the title is Baking Powder Wars, The Cutthroat Fight That Revolutionized Cooking by Linda Civitello. You can get it from Amazon. Go to your favorite bookstore. If they don't have it, ask them to order it for you and tell them to get two or three more because somebody else is going to want this that you know as well. And this is – thank you so much.
You know who you need to have market this? You know where this needs to be sold? Bed Bath & Beyond and Williams Sonoma. Cooking stores.
Well,
I mean, seriously, why not?
Well, she's got the University of Illinois Press behind her, so I think they should be able to handle that.
I hope so. Yeah. That on.
Good luck, Linda.
Mother Goose.